Today on the Inside Flap.
They basically are able to analyze your muscles in your face and how they move, because there's a finite number of muscles and a finite way that they would move.
Right.
And each one is depicting sort of what's going on or how you're acting. And so they did this with couples, and they were able to predict, and I'm not remembering the exact figures, but it was in the 90% accuracy of whether they would survive, the marriage would survive over a year. Wow. There's really kind of no limit to how fast it'll keep getting faster, and it'll keep getting smarter, and kind of on a level we can't really comprehend, because you're talking about, you know, 15 seconds being able to read the entire encyclopedia.
Right? Oh, geez.
And wow. Then you add on to that what it can learn itself if it decides it wants to experiment with black holes or theoretical physics or whatever field it sort of is moving into. The speeds at which things will eventually be working is going to, you know, make what humans can do seem pretty pathetic.
The Inside Flap is available on demand every week on iTunes, Stitcher, the Google Play Store, and around the world on theinsideflap.com.
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today on this Inside Chat edition. My name is Dave Medicus. Welcome to the show. Seated across the desk to my right is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
Howdy. We appreciate you guys joining us today. Welcome. We have a good guest for you today, and we are happy that you are joining us on
The Inside Flap.
Thank you for joining us. The show today is brought to you by IndieBound. And make sure you visit our website, theinsideflap.com, and click on over to the IndieBound link. Head there while you're doing your book buying. It doesn't cost you a cent, and it helps to support the show as well as independent bookstores everywhere. All right, I guess today is Brian Nelson. The name of his book is The Last Swordmaker. Great title. Mm-hmm. Really great title.
Yeah, it is.
Great book. Really fun conversation with Brian. We'll have that for you in just a little bit. But first, time for a little public service announcement to our listeners. Now, guys out there and gals out there, people out there in general, you might have heard that it is possible this November that we might have an issue with mail-in balloting.
Oh, I wasn't sure what we were talking about.
That's what we're talking about. We're talking about mail-in balloting. There's been an awful lot of talk about it, and I know, you know, I was skeptical of any problems with mail-in voting. I mean, we've been here in Colorado, we've been doing it for years,
Six years.
So
honestly, here's the thing.
Yes.
I vote every election.
Right.
Actually, I did not vote.
Congratulations.
In the, there was some weird.
There we go.
Yeah, I got a random one for something with firefighters, and I didn't know who to vote for. I did not vote in whatever that was. It was something local involving the fire department.
We get allowed to firefighters.
There was something with the fire. I don't know. I have no idea. It looked like the fire department was sending me something. But I can't remember the last time that I voted in person.
Yeah,
it was
a long time ago. It's been an awful long time.
It might have been Obama. Probably.
Wow, really?
It must have been Obama. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So anyway, we recently had another. It was the primary. It was another with some things on the ballot. Also,
local
some,
stuff.
Local things, local issues, some initiatives. So you know, Laura and I filled it out. Well, here's what happened. I can just tell you this, that I received a notification in the mail about this, and yeah, this guy here with the two thumbs,
Dave Medicus,
your favorite book podcaster, has been found guilty of voter fraud. Now, luckily, I don't think there's any jail sentence or a fine associated with this.
I mean, there might be.
But listen, it was completely nefarious and insidious on my part, and I apologize to the United States of America, but yes, it is true. I had Laura sign my name to my ballot. And I got caught! I got caught. The signature. Now, who knew that they kept these things on file? Because the signature that Laura put on the ballot did not match.
The thing is, Dave,
my signature.
A lot of partners listening out there, you end up signing your partner's signature
all the time.
I know our house, when we bought our house, one of our houses, it came down to, we'll just tell you how old this is, a last minute fax.
That's right. Yes.
And I forged your signature to get the house.
Right. Mm-hmm. But now they're going to come take the house away from us.
We've already sold that house. So.
Okay, good. Yeah. We're good to go. No.
But like, I think most partners know how to forge the other person's signature. Well, and I will say,
let's circle back to that for 1 second.
Remember distinctly because you were on your boys' trip with Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not. Usually I know how to forge your signature and I do it a certain way. And I actually didn't take care.
I see. Because now you know my signature.
Did it.
It's basically an illegible scrawl.
Yes.
It's pretty much just two wavy lines.
I signed it similar to my style, my own style.
Yeah, you signed it like, because they sent it back to me. You signed it like you were aiming for for first prize in a calligraphy contest.
No, I didn't even do it that well. But it was, the thing is, it wasn't that off of your normal signature.
Oh, it was
But it was a little more graceful than what you typically do and what I would have done for you, too.
Yeah. It's amazing that it came back.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for those people out there thinking that voter fraud doesn't happen, it happens.
Yeah.
They're out to, they're looking for it.
So sorry, Hickenlooper, you didn't get one extra vote.
I mean, he got in anyway, so, you know. Anyway, that's what's going on. So just be careful out there. Be careful. Sign your own name to your own ballot.
You weren't around. I had to turn it in.
No, I know. I'm not blaming you at all. What is 100%?
It's just kind of funny.
My fault. The ballot had been sitting on the counter for weeks at a time.
Yeah,
and I had not gotten around to sign it. So clearly that is my fault right there.
It's pretty funny.
All right, well, let's get to it. Our guest today is Brian Nelson. His new book is called The Last Swordmaker. This is such a good book. This is one of those books, you know, sometimes you get them, and it's great when you get them, that it's just so hard to put down. It just keeps you up late at night reading. This is a thriller set in 2025 in a world. Oh, I need that guy. I need that guy's drop. In a world where the U.S. and China are racing to perfect a technology involving genetics, artificial intelligence, and nanotechnology.
Hmm.
Now, the winner of this race will be able to weaponize this technology, as in, pretty much, they'll be in control of this new weapon. And this new weapon are like little, like gnats or little tiny flies that can get inside your, but they're, you know, the size of an atom or smaller than an atom that can you can direct and get inside of someone's body. And within the snap of a finger or a push of a keyboard, you can infect them with the virus and kill them immediately.
Hmm.
It's a really cool technology. And if you're a murderer.
Yeah, I guess so.
And so you've got all these scientists on both sides working furiously, you know, for months at a time, working overtime, trying to be the first country to get this new technology. Now, somehow Brian Nelson makes a group of scientists working at the lab very exciting and tense. We also see what's going on in China as they battle furiously to get there first. There are double agents. There are scientists that are used as pawns. Shirts that can block bullets. Classic torture scenes. It all gets more and more frantic and exciting as the pace takes off. And the climactic, listen, this scene at the end of the book, the climax, it really just seems tailor-made for a damn good action movie.
I was going to say, it sounds like a great movie.
The whole book just begged, maybe that's why I was thinking, in a world.
Yeah.
It really just begs to be made into a movie. Mm. I could not put this one down. Check it out. It's called The Last Swordmaker. And check out our conversation with Brian. Here it is for you. It was a lot of fun. He was a great guy to talk to. He was funny because he was, you'll hear where he was recording from and how that came about in the conversation. Pretty funny.
Really likable guy.
Yeah, very likable. Here it is for you right now. This is Brian Nelson. Anyway, thanks for joining us. I loved your book, The Last Swordmaker. So good. Amazing. Could not put it down. Really, really good.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, it had me well up past my bedtime. This is a futuristic. It did. And I curse you for that. But like I said, or you could gather, I'm a teacher, so it's summer's off, so no big deal.
Yeah. Good.
This is a futuristic, scientific, action-packed military thriller featuring a race between China and the U.S. to be the first to master a weapon combining genetics, artificial intelligence, and nanotechnology. Oh, and this book also features a pig sporting a tie-dye shirt, which, I mean, how can you go wrong with that? It was pretty awesome. Brian Nelson, what inspired your book, The Last Swordmaker?
Well, there are quite a few inspirations.
Uh-huh. There's a lot going on in this book.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. One of the first inspirations, though, was an article that came out in Wired magazine back in 1999, maybe 2000, by Bill Joy. And Bill Joy was the guy who created VI and he's one of the kind of founding fathers of technology. Mm. He's not quite as famous as Bill Gates or Steve Jobs, but he was kind of one of these revolutionary thinkers. And he wrote this article called Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. Oh. And in that article, he was looking at things that had been written by Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he said, I don't agree with this guy's methods, but I agree with his predictions about what's going to happen in the future. So the sort of prediction of increasing automation, of not really needing human labor anymore, and some of the advances that might go along with that. And he was talking more about robotics at that point. Not so much into AI, but definitely genetic engineering as well. And so I sort of modified some of those ideas and did some more reading and sort of came up with this sort of merging of those ideas, those emerging technologies you talked about, which is AI, genetic engineering, and nanotechnology, and how those might sort of be merged to create different things.
Wow. Mm. Do you think nanotechnology is something that I need to be worried about?
If you read this book, you will be.
See, you're laughing, but I don't know.
And, I have to tell you, as someone who likes, to do a lot of reading and watch a lot of movies, you often see nanotechnology as this sort of Deus Ex Machina sort of tool used by an author or a director to sort of get past a problem. We sent in some nanobots or we sent in some
explains a lot
or whatever, and that fixed the problem. And I've always hated that, right? Because I didn't think that the author or the filmmaker was kind of doing their work, right? So I did want to kind of go into this and sort of see, okay, is this for real? Is this stuff really going to be that transformative? Mm-hmm. And it's really fascinating because it will.
Wow.
And the history is really interesting too, because even back in the 50s, and you might remember this quote from the book, we had people like Richard Feynman, who's a Nobel Prize winning physicist, yep. Mm-hmm. who was also involved with the Manhattan Project, saying, hey, there's really no reason why we can't manipulate things atom by atom. It's not something that's going to violate any laws. It's just that we can't do it right now because we're too big. We're too big.
Right.
And so that's a really interesting idea, right? Because when you think about what's the difference between hazardous waste and seawater and what's the difference between cancer cells and healthy cells, it's how you arrange the atoms. Mm-hmm. And so if you kind of take that idea and you're like, well, that sounds really fantastic. Well, fantastical, right? How could you do that? But of course, we're doing it all the time. It's happening all around us. Mm. So when we eat and we digest our food, how does the potassium in the banana we eat get to our brain or to our muscle? Or how does your eyelash blink? Or what's happening in that chemical process? And that's really these tiny machines, which we call proteins and enzymes, that are breaking things apart at the atomic level. And super fast and super powerful, but it's one of those technologies that we have never been able to sort of tap into yet. It's there, we can see it, we know it works, but we're still figuring out how to do it ourselves.
Wow.
But we have a model, which is ourselves, which will allow us to do it eventually.
That's kind of exciting.
I don't find it exciting after reading this book.
Oh, yeah.
I'm petrified, terrified and petrified. I'm not petrified is what I am.
Banana, you are fascinated by bananas, aren't you? What do you? I read a quote. You said something about a banana. You had a fun fact about a banana. What was that?
Oh, yeah. That was funny. That actually comes up. The second book is now in press, but that actually is something I actually worked into the second book. In the
oh, really? Series. Oh, awesome. Yeah. Okay. We'll look forward to that.
Basically, yeah, bananas are one of the few ways in which we can get antimatter on Earth. Antimatter is extremely difficult to come by. It'll happen sometimes in a lightning storm, or sometimes the atmosphere gets bombarded a little bit. But the amount of antimatter that humans have been able to produce in a laboratory isn't enough to boil a cup of water.
Hmm.
But wow. Bananas produce antimatter. Like every 75 seconds, a banana will produce a piece of antimatter.
What?
So
this is
there's
crazy.
A way, because it has a radioactive isotope in it. So wow. If you had a way to like capture those with perhaps advanced nanotechnology, you could sort of harvest them and create something that could project you through space at essentially like light speed.
That's so interesting, because I was at the dentist the other day and they had a chart of radioactive things. And I did see bananas and also living inside a brick, cement, or stone house also.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Ooh. Huh.
Yeah. Very interesting, yeah.
And I remember Doc Brown in Back to the Future, if you remember, at the end of the movie, he grabs banana peels and starts throwing it into the DeLorean.
Exactly.
So that might, maybe there was
intention or not, but maybe they...
maybe he was onto something there. Christopher Lloyd was like, no, we need to get bananas. We need bananas.
That's right. I read about this.
But you do talk about a lot of science in this book, and there is a lot of science. And it's interesting for someone like me, a lowly drama teacher who barely passed science in high school, you write about it in such a way that makes it easily digestible, if you'll pardon the pun, speaking of bananas. But how much of a balancing act is it for you, who obviously has got has got your mind wrapped around all this technology? How hard is it for you not to just go way overboard with the science, but you're just able to write about it so eloquently that makes it so digestible for us?
Yeah. You know, this book was a long time in coming. Probably in the first drafts, I was way too much.
I bet. Yeah.
And so I sort of had to like make sure I was easing people into it and really kind of build up the front end of the story before I kind of dove into it. So I really, you know, I tried to make this a very kind of character-driven novel. You know?
Yeah, and it really
I had
is.
A pretty
yeah.
big cast of characters.
Yep.
And I think as a novelist, as a writer, that's kind of one of the most important or satisfying things I find about a book is being able to switch point of views and gathering more information from each new perspective. So, you know, I wanted to have, you know, I had China is sort of the Chinese government anyway, sort of the bad guys.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely wanted to portray them. And even though they're, you know, there's bad guys and good guys who are Chinese, I wanted the readers to be able to empathize with each of those points of view. Mm-hmm. So even if it's a high military figure or you're looking at a soldier's point of view or the young scientists who get caught up in the espionage and the sabotage between the two countries, I really wanted to have fun moving through those different points of view and building up those characters and kind of weaving it all together.
Yeah, and you really do that a lot. It jumps back and forth a lot, just enough to keep us going and keep the action propelling, which is you know, really important, I think. And there are some, you were talking about, good guys and bad guys. So you've got double agents in this book. And one of them gets caught out by the use of something called micro-expressions, which I never heard of this, and I think it is fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about this micro? I want to try it out on all my friends now. I'm going to start recording conversations. What are these micro? And I'm recording you right now. No. You know, this is an audio podcast.
Guys,
but
is this a sincere smile or is this a fake smile? But yes, they basically are able to analyze your muscles in your face and how they move, because there's a finite number of muscles and a finite way that they would move.
Right.
And each one is depicting sort of what's going on or how you're acting. And what they can do with footage, and actually the original research on this was with married couples.
Oh.
So they would look at married couples just gotten married, and they'd do these, you know, they'd have them talk, and they'd videotape them. And they'd look for these kind of signals,
wow.
which is you're kind of always acting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are certain moments that sort of guise drops.
Right. And
you're sort of sincere. It's kind of like the sly look away, right?
Yeah.
And so they did this with couples, and they were able to predict, and I'm not remembering the exact figures, but it was in the 90% accuracy of whether they would survive, the marriage would survive over a year.
Wow.
So
it's kind of creepy.
What they often picked up on was contempt. If one partner flashed this kind of contempt signal for the other one while they were talking, it was like
no good
that they were not going to make it.
Wow.
Oh my God. This sounds like
we need to get those experts on for the presidential debates.
Exactly.
What are they really telling us here?
Wow. Yeah, this is a good futuristic lie detector, it seems, you know?
Exactly. Well, you know, you throw in mass surveillance now, right? Mm-hmm. You used to see it, some of the programs that they're starting in China, whatever, where people are being filmed all the time.
Yeah.
You can get a sense of, you know, how that person, not just who that person is or where they are, but how they're feeling and what their emotions are at any moment by the video footage that you're analyzing.
Wow. Nobody's going to get away with anything anymore. This is terrible.
That's right. Kids, like, you keep it on your kids.
Oh, yeah.
You know, your kids are lying, right?
Yeah.
There'll be an app for it. You just hold them up. Okay, tell me what really happened.
Oh, wow.
And, I'm going to videotape it, and I'll know whether you're lying or not.
Damn. That's funny. Now, you've also got a lot of amazing artificial intelligence stuff in this book, and you talk about... you mentioned this big bang for AI and where that could mean that man is going to be left in the dust. What is this all about? What is this big bang that you refer to, this new big bang?
Right. So you think about the human brain and kind of what it's able to digest and process, and that seems to be finite, right?
Right.
But if you take a computer and you hook it up to the internet and it can learn off, you know, learn anything. It can keep learning and keep learning and keep learning and keep learning. It's kind of infinite.
Right.
And if you add sort of machine learning or the ability to sort of process data and real artificial intelligence or deep learning, where you're actually able to make connections between that data, then you've got an artificial intelligence system that's going to get much, much smarter than any human very fast.
Wow.
And again, there's kind of no limit. It can sort of these are some themes I'm dealing with in the second book, but there's really kind of no limit to how fast it'll keep getting faster and it'll keep getting smarter, and kind of on a level we can't really comprehend, because you're talking about, you know, in, you know, 15 seconds being able to read the entire encyclopedia.
Right? Oh, geez.
And then you add on to that what it can learn itself if it decides it wants to experiment with black holes or theoretical physics or whatever field it sort of is moving into. The speeds at which things will eventually be working is going to, you know, make what humans can do seem pretty pathetic.
Mm-hmm. Wow. How much research did you do for this book? Because it sounds like you could teach like a course, a whole course on different things. And maybe you should.
This book, read the book.
Because it would
more
be an entertaining.
It's much more entertaining than to sit through a course.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's funny. I wouldn't say I did a ton of research.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with 6 or 7 well-done books in the field, you know, you feel like you can kind of play with those and create your own kind of variations on them. And that's what I like to do. I sometimes find that if I do research on a subject too much, then it limits my creativity.
Right.
And I find, it really works like this instead of the kind of the way I imagined it. I'll go with the way I imagined it over the way it really works.
No, that's a good point.
And that's kind of an axiom when I'm writing. I think about, okay, what is cooler? Is it interesting, you know, to do it what's real, or what I imagined or what I could sort of brainstorm about is more interesting? I always go with what's more interesting.
Yeah.
You got to go with the, I know there's a lot of cool stuff in this book. And when in doubt, go cool.
Yeah.
Now you talk about book two. When is that coming out? I can't wait for this book two. What do you have a title for that?
Yeah, actually, the title is Five Tribes.
Ooh.
And we're just finishing some of the artwork.
Oh, I saw some online, which is really, really good.
And it will be out on March 21st. March 21st next year.
Cool. Awesome. Very good.
Very cool. And you, so you hold several different degrees in, I think, international relations, economics, and creative writing. Which one was the hardest for you?
Actually, economics.
Yeah.
That's, yeah, I mean, I can't even imagine.
I don't think I'd last. Maybe I could take the first intro course, and then after that, I'd be I'd be out.
I'm 5 minutes into the first class.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the, is it the
university
it's the,
I went to, which is Miami of Ohio, was famous for having a very hard economics degree. So it was kind of, you know, you felt that if you were getting B's in that class, that you were doing awesome.
B's,
right?
B's are awesome for that. Yeah. That's wild.
But economics, I think, is really interesting because it teaches you a very kind of detached way of thinking, very sort of detached way of looking at the world, how things work. And at human behavior, which I think has been very helpful in things like, for example, going to Venezuela, where I lived for several years under Hugo Chavez, who was obviously a very dramatically left-leaning president. But looking at the way that politics work from an economic lens, or looking at the way, you know, is very kind of enlightening and lets you just kind of get your emotions out of things.
Oh, wow.
It allows you to see things in a kind of raw perspective, which I think is very useful. And I honestly think a lot of people don't ever kind of develop that sense of, you know, coming away from the way that you were indoctrinated or learned to look at the world and looking at it kind of from a detached perspective.
It's hard to do, I think, because it's really hard to take away that emotion.
Yeah.
That's so interesting about economics. I didn't realize that about it.
Clearly, you're using your degree in creative writing.
Not using them all, right?
So exactly. Kudos there. Yeah.
So I went through a few sort of different career paths. Right after graduation, so I studied econ and international relations in college. Then I worked in as a stockbroker for several years.
Oh, wow.
Then I worked in international finance for a company called EDS, which was essentially part of General Motors. So I was in Detroit, so I was doing stuff for General Motors financing. And that was in Latin America, which was interesting.
Wow.
And then I sort of had what I call my quarter life crisis, because I didn't make it to midlife to have my first crisis. I just decided it kind of wasn't me. And that's when I went back and got a master's in creative writing.
That is so cool. Yeah.
That's cool.
What did the corporate people around you say when you told them what you were doing?
I actually did. I just kind of went.
You just were like, I'm out.
Like, hey, this is where I'm going. It's just like, see ya. We'll see if I make it or not.
Yeah. It's more like what they were saying about you behind your back as you walked away. This idiot.
Were you always interested in writing as a young, like as a younger person? Was it something that you loved doing and you just kind of changed a little bit as you got older?
Yeah, it was. I remember, you know, a very specific moment in like eighth grade where I had a teacher say, oh, this, you know, the story you wrote is really, really good. And then that was kind of empowering in the sense that, oh, you know, maybe I'm pretty good at this. And I wrote a lot in high school, but it was that situation where you feel like you have to be pragmatic when you go to college.
Yeah, for sure.
You have to study something that's going to be.
It's going
to
earn some money. Yeah. And useful to the world. Yeah.
And that was what, and I really enjoyed my time, you know, in Detroit and working for GM, but it was empowering it because it let me know that, okay, I can make it in this field if I want. And I was able to look around and see the other people in the office and say, okay, if I stay here 10 years, I'll be there. If I stay for 12 years, I'll be there. Right.
Yeah.
And say, and it's kind of like, well, if I want to come back to this, I can.
Yes.
So why don't I try to do that thing that I wasn't sure I could really do? Which is the writing.
That's so great. Yeah. Now, do you speak Spanish then if you were working in Latin America?
Yeah. And that's actually the only reason that GM hired me. Leaders or finance that well. They're like, you speak Spanish, we'll train you on the rest. Come on.
Yeah, that's really useful. So, yeah.
Yeah.
You do some good hiking down there, or what are you doing down there in Venezuela?
So I was there in Venezuela for 1 year of high school. So the interesting part of my family history is both my parents studied foreign diplomacy.
Wow.
So it was kind of mandatory that all of us, my older sisters and I, that we take off.
Wow.
We had to get out of the house.
Wow.
We were kicked out of the house. And they sent my eldest sister went to Mexico for high school, a year of high school, and then she went to Spain for a year of college. My other sister went to South Africa for a year
wow.
of high school, and then to Kenya for a year of college. I went to Venezuela for a year of high school and to Australia for a year of college. So it's kind of like a mandatory international exposure in our house. And so that was really interesting.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Do you think that helped shape your – clearly it must have shaped your worldview. Do you think it it must have really assisted you in life?
Yeah. Again, that kind of changing perspective and seeing how other people live and one of the things that, you know, this is kind of combined economics and international studies, but being in Australia, the tax rates in Australia are extremely high, close to like 50%.
Wow.
Whoa.
So which creates a disincentive to work.
It does.
Right? Because if you work
because it's going, you're working for your government. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But that also creates this. This kind of passion within the population to have things other than work to occupy your time.
Oh.
So you have a lot of people who work 6 hours a day and then go off and do something else, or who are spending a lot of time saving up their money so they can travel around the world.
Huh.
So that's an interesting kind of way that traveling kind of helps you see how other people live. You're like, oh, I don't have to work 9 to 5 every day of my life
yeah.
and still have life, which is kind of the American model.
Yeah, it definitely is. Yeah. And yeah. Since you live in Colorado, that is something, because we used to live in New York City and worked in New York, and the work ethic there is crazy.
Yeah.
And coming out here, it was just a breath of fresh air. You know, it's like,
you're
I can
expect to be outside. Right?
Yes, you are. Expect... You can wear blue jeans. You don't have to wear a suit. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, Brian, it's time now for our segment we call Fast 8-8 Fast Questions, in which we find out a little bit more about you. First of all, what is that painting behind you? That looks
it's a wall. It's a wall hanging.
Is it a wall hanging?
Looks like it.
Looks like that painting that we have.
It's a wall hanging. I cannot actually tell you because a group of bad storms came through last night, and the internet in my house is out. So I'm actually visiting someone else's house.
That's
no
really
way.
Funny.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I'm sorry.
Sorry
well,
about
thank
that.
You.
I made that question. Zero for one.
That wasn't even part of
it. That was just
a
prelude. Here
we go. That's Dave being distracted.
Yep, I just distracted. Here we go. What is the last show you watched and or binged and really enjoyed?
The Sound of Music, last night.
Hey.
I have a 10-year-old boy and a 7-year-old boy, and we watched The Sound of Music.
Aww.
And they really got into it, and I was amazed. It was great.
That's awesome.
That's a great. I love that one.
Yeah, you do, yeah.
If you could time travel to any period in time, what and where would it be? Doesn't have to be accurate.
Sorry, go ahead.
It doesn't have to be accurate. My time machine's not ready yet.
It's funny. So I've tricked my kids into playing a lot of Dungeons and Dragons, old school Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, nice. Awesome.
They don't. The trick is that they're working on their storytelling and narrative skills. Play the character building. So we actually play a lot of Dungeons and Dragons. So my first thought is that a medieval time period would be interesting.
Yeah.
But it would need to be populated with magic and
yes, sure.
My life expectancy would need to be above, you know, the typical PI.
And you need some magical skills.
Yeah.
Yes.
Definitely.
Yeah. I like it.
Brian, what is something that people often get wrong about you?
Well, people aren't sure whether I'm a really nerdy, cool guy or a really cool, nerdy guy. So that's what I've been told. I'm sort of walking that balance.
Yeah.
So I'm quite a nerd, but a lot of people don't think I look like a nerd.
That's
no,
funny.
I don't think so.
I can see that. Yeah. You didn't look like what I thought you'd look like. Yeah. So what is a movie you would not skip past while flipping through the channels?
Anything that's hard school sci-fi, like any James Cameron sci-fi.
Oh, okay. Really?
You know, you Aliens or Terminator or one of those James Cameron flicks. I just can't resist.
Those are great movies.
Yep.
Yeah.
What is one book you'll never forget?
Here's a nerdy side of me. Okay. This is good. This is a book called The Worldly Philosophers, which is a history of the great economic thinkers. So it's dense, it's fat, and it's thick.
Wow.
It completely changed my perspective of the world. It's a fantastic book.
Wow.
Robert Heilbronner wrote it. And it's an incredible book because you look at the history of economics through the from the perspective or through the biography of all these famous people like Adam Smith, Karl Marx, Ricardo, Keynes. And then you just it gives you a perspective on the world that you're like, oh, well, that's why that time period was like that. Or that's why it's really interesting because each period, you know, sort of shows how that person developed their thinking. So you understand why Marx felt the way he did because of the time period he was living in. And the same with Ricardo or Adam Smith. So super nerdy, but transformative in a lot of ways.
Wow, yeah. Sounds great. Okay, I don't know if you do this, but what is your go-to karaoke song? Or what song would you...
Hotel California.
Ah,
Hotel
nice.
California. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I can actually carry the tune.
That's so important, isn't it? Yeah.
What is a favorite meal of yours?
Tortellini.
Pasta is a good comfort. And last but not least, what book are you currently reading?
I am reading The Magician's Nephew by C.S. Lewis.
Oh, really?
Okay. I probably have read
my
that.
My 10-year-old is going through the whole series right now. And he's like, you got to read this. And I'm like, all right.
Yeah. When they bring you a book and tell you, you have to read, to read that.
They do that. Yeah, they do that. Yeah.
Good for you. Cool.
Yeah. All right, Brian. Listen, thanks so much for spending a little time with us. I really enjoyed it. And I loved your book, The Last Swordmaker. So
much.
Good.
I really appreciate the time and for talking to fellow Coloradians.
That's right.
Thank you.
And tell your neighbor, thanks.
Thanks.
They can come. You can let them out of the basement now.
That's right. No noise.
No noise.
Oh, no.
They're That's just funny. Sitting out there on a couch. Yeah.
Can we move now? Can we move?
Yeah.
That's funny.
Thanks
All right,
for your
Brian,
time.
Take care. Have
right,
a good day.
Take care.
Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
The Inside Flap.
All right, there you go, Brian. Straight from his neighbor's house, Brian Nelson. Poor guy. I felt bad for him.
Well, he wasn't even in our state because he lives in our state.
Yeah.
I think he was in like Iowa or Ohio or someplace
Ohio.
Like
he
that.
He said he was in Ohio.
Yeah. So probably visiting family members or something like that. Yeah. And then
I wonder how well
go.
He actually knew those neighbors.
Probably not well. And I pictured people just like politely and nervously sitting on a sofa, like outside the door.
Oh,
like
you
waiting.
Want us to, are you... Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll just.
I also pictured.
Then.
Here's another thing that I pictured. Yeah. I pictured his parents being like nervously, like Brian's parents,
Brian's
like older
parents.
Older people, like nervously, like my son has an interview.
Oh, so they went over
and
first.
And so you know how your parents can still do that, and even though you're a grown person, you feel like
a book.
He makes you feel like you're, you know, 14 true. Again.
Yeah.
And I pictured that happening to Brian. He was a grown man.
That'd be great.
And having his mom like
go over there.
Yeah.
Now listen, it's just gonna take 30 minutes. Listen. You can go. Can you go into the backyard? It's not too bad out there right
How's
now.
How's your Wi-Fi?
Oh, man. Yeah. So a real trooper. We appreciate Brian.
And,
love that book, The Last Swordmaker. Check it out. Really, really good stuff. All right. That'll do it for us. This has been the Inside Chat, a version of the Inside Flap podcast. My name is Dave Medicus. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back later on this weekend for a full show with book recommendations and Andrew Dowd. Until then, we'll see ya.
Adios. My time machine's not ready yet.